You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. I'm Rayshon Ray, a David Rubenstein Fellow at the Brookings Institution in the Governance Studies Department. I want to welcome you for joining us this afternoon to talk about the effects of the coronavirus outbreak on marginalized communities. As we know, a jobs report just came out today. Unemployment claims soared to 6.6 million, accumulating to about a total of 10 million over the past couple of weeks. I'm joined here today by Camille Bousset, who is a senior fellow in economic studies, governance studies, and the Metropolitan Policy Program, who currently runs the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative, as well as Makeda Henry Nicky, who is a fellow in governance studies. I want to open it up for Camille to give opening remarks on this topic.
Thanks, Rayshon. I want to thank everyone who has joined us for this event and who has submitted questions prior to the event. We are really grateful that you are choosing to take your time now during a moment of national crisis to participate in this conversation with us. So thank you for that. I do not think it's an exaggeration to say that what we are experiencing is the most profound human catastrophe and economic collapse in the last century in the U.S. The effects are profound across the country, but they are particularly damaging for the tens of millions of vulnerable Americans who, by virtue of their health, income, race, immigration, housing, employment, or criminal justice status, have been left to fend for themselves. This crisis has exposed the web of neglect that is so deeply inculcated in our culture, in our politics, in our economy. And it has also exposed the ways in which we have become complacent with putting the economy before human beings. It is inexcusable that in the wealthiest country in the world, we haven't figured out how to provide ample testing for the virus, nor PPEs to people who are on the medical front lines or packing groceries, nor found a way to provide safe shelter for our homeless populations, or a way to declare a payment holiday on COVID-19 coronavirus medical treatment. While we're going to be discussing the current situation today, I also do want to spend some time during this event to focus on what comes next. So thanks, Rayshon.
Yeah, that's a great opening, Camille. And as we know, it's no secret that in major disasters, the well-off oftentimes have more resources and can withstand the impact of pandemics like this one. So to you, Camille, what are the short-term and long-term implications of this pandemic, particularly for poor and low-income people and other vulnerable communities? And I really think that this question relates to a question we received from Arlissa Gamblin from Bread of the World Institute. And her question was about the importance of applying a racial equity framework and lens in responding to the coronavirus.
So I appreciate those questions. I appreciate the question you just asked. I mean, I think in the long term, this is certainly devastating for vulnerable populations. I don't think there's any question about that. In the short term, it's also devastating, but in some very specific ways. So a good portion of middle-class folks and upper income folks can work from home, can self-isolate. There are lots of accounts of wealthy people building bunkers or moving out to Long Island where they have extra houses, et cetera. That is obviously not possible for people who are poor and low income. And often when you are poor or low income, you're also living in fairly dense populated housing quarters, which makes it from a health perspective, I think much more devastating and potentially dangerous. Economically, poor and low-income Americans can't afford not to work. So if they have lost their jobs, then it's going to be very difficult for them to make ends meet. If they are currently working, they need those jobs, so they're going to be exposed to the virus. And if they need those jobs and if they're working, their kids who are now no longer in school are going to be left behind, even if there's virtual online education, because it requires a certain level of parental guidance and parental presence. So I think from a number of perspectives, having to work when there are no protective and there's no protection, having to be in housing situations that don't allow for quarantining, that's, I think, certainly very, very devastating for a lot of people. And then we have folks who are vulnerable because of their status, their immigration status, for instance. So they can't apply for aid, they can't apply for help because their immigration status is such that it doesn't allow them to do that. We also have incarcerated populations, and it's not clear to me that we're making enough efforts there to protect them. And then, of course, we have vulnerable populations like a lot of our folks in Indian country who already have very, very poor health care in general, and this is not going to make it any better. And in fact, they could be very deeply impacted in the short term.
Yeah, I think that's a great response. And then obviously it really highlights several of the questions that we received about vulnerable populations. Makeda, I want to bring you in and build on this point. So we know that Congress recently passed a $2 trillion stimulus package. Is that really going to help vulnerable populations? I mean, who's left out of this package? I think when a lot of people look at this package, they see direct checks, but they don't necessarily know how that's going to really impact everyday communities that are really vulnerable when it comes to what's happening with the coronavirus, when it comes to health, education, and the like. And I think this question really relates to one we received from Tom Armstrong from the City of Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, who's interested in the financial gap after federal assistance has been provided from this stimulus package as it relates to direct checks and payments to families and children. So can you kind of speak to that gap that might still exist and the ways that it's going to impact vulnerable populations?
Sure. So first, let me say there are 211,000 affected persons and 4,700 plus families who've lost loved ones to COVID-19. These people come from all income levels, backgrounds, neighborhoods, and family contexts. And so I know that we're going to focus today a lot on low income and the most vulnerable. I want to remember that this is an equal opportunity disease that impacts every strata. Yes, we know that this crisis, as Camille said earlier, is exposing, I think, the most disturbing and appalling kinds of income and class inequalities in our society across health, education, and financial well-being dimensions. But I'd also want to sort of, step through this in time. We are dealing with a crisis that has no playbook in history. We can't go back to medieval times. The Great Recession does not provide a roadmap for dealing with the kind of disruption that we're dealing with today. So I want to, first say kudos to the advocates, the lobbyists, the Hill staffers that have all poured in to shape the CARE Act. Without them, the 84.2 million underinsured and uninsured Americans would be left exposed. There are, of course, going to be health outcomes, but I would prefer us to be in a place where we've got 44 million people who are now more likely to choose to seek help from or talk to a medical professional about, possible COVID symptoms. We know that people are asymptomatic, but what we're not talking about are the people who have mild symptoms that might look like a flu. And they are, wondering, I'm being covered by a high deductible plan. Should I use my scarce dollars in these uncertain times to go talk to a professional about a cold, or should I pay rent? Yesterday, about $43 billion in rent was due on the first of the month. $43 billion. And this morning, our UI rolls swelled to 10 million people. A lot of them are filing unemployment claims for the first time. So there's a lot of instability and vulnerability in the system. And I also don't want to forget the community impact here. And I'm sorry to sort of jump around a little bit, but, a lot of these employment status service offices are going to be inundated with historic levels of demand for applications. They themselves are now moving to virtual environments, and they're doing this in a very rushed, abrupt kind of way. So the system is under incredible stress. I really think that, one, we need to sort of slow down and, really kind of acknowledge that the CARE Act is bold, it's innovative, it will touch almost every crucial element of the social safety net that we need it to touch. Will it provide 100% exhaustive coverage? No, it won't. And you're right to ask, after these temporary provisions sunset, what happens next? I'm particularly concerned for the people whose jobs will be permanently lost. And state systems are built to their, I think there was a 2018 Solvency Trust Fund that came, a report that came out a couple of years ago, like I said, a couple of years ago. What that report showed was that about 29 states were barely able to cover their, trust fund, their unemployment, insurance obligations. And so that means they're going to be on the market pretty soon, even after the CARES Act funds are exhausted, borrowing. And so, we're going to be facing a lot of systematic stresses and states are going to be making decisions about, where to make budget cuts. School budgets are usually top of the line. Social safety net programs come next. We have a lot to step through. I just don't think that it makes sense to sort of start off this conversation about who gets left out, and let's kind of start in a different place and try to make sure that we walk this together in a cooperative spirit.
Okay, so Makeda, I want to follow up quickly with a question that we received from Francine Alkasani from the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. What is the impact on historically Black colleges and universities here, and what role should HBCUs be playing, considering that they serve a disproportionate number of vulnerable populations? I mean, I think we can also think about religious organizations in this regard. So it's a couple of different ways to think about this. And I'm curious your perspective on how we think about who's included, who's left out, but also what people can be doing and what institutions can be doing to serve the people that they're primarily interacting with.
Thanks. And thanks, Francine, for your question. I know HBCUs are near and dear to your heart. For me, there are three sort of critical areas. Out the door, like between now and the fall, I think that there's going to be a lot of strain on their IT infrastructure. And I don't want to minimize it or think about, systems as opposed to people. But when you have, the entire system going online in, overnight almost, they're going to experience a lot of strain. These universities have been chronically underfunded for decades. And many have, rationally so, delayed the costly upgrades to their systems. And so this is going to be catastrophic, for the institutions that are less capitalized, have older legacy systems. And when those systems fail, that's going to really have an impact on students. To follow on, about 75% of HBCU students qualify for Pell Grants. And so that means I worry about how many of them will return in the fall. If enrollment drops too far, that can put some HBCUs in a pretty precarious position that will, threaten their accreditation status. Thinking of the kinds of decisions that will, have these HBCUs, these HBCU students deciding not to return to school, they're probably going to have to fill the gap back home and start providing and probably delay their education for much longer. And we know from all of the research, all of the data, particularly that, the accountability conversation around, investing in an MBA, for example, and coming out with mountains of debt, and then you're just working as a bank teller. There's so much, I think, concern about what happens to these students if they don't return. I want to applaud. My heart was lifted when I saw a couple of days ago that the Maryland settled that HBCU settlement, and it's about a little bit over $500 million. But that's in favor of four institutions. I'm worried about the other 103 who don't have that kind of economic lifeline. And I think, this is probably where we need our brightest minds and our, CDFIs, for example, who are, sitting on some very flexible, social minded kind of investment dollars to come in and help shore up these balance sheets. I think after we get through the next, 120 days, when you come to the fall, what's going to happen in the long term? I don't foresee, any more political room to go back and ask the Senate led by Mitch McConnell or this administration to put some sort of special carve out on the table for HBCUs specifically. So I think we really need to put our heads together because there are some institutions in this community who will be at risk for, closure in the near future.
Okay, so I want to ask a question that we recently received from the audience about data. So one of the big things we know, and Makeda, you just highlighted how pervasive the coronavirus is just in the United States. I mean, not to mention what's happening around the globe. But as we think about that, we're starting to see huge spikes in places like Milwaukee, Detroit, New Orleans. These are predominantly Black cities. They are oftentimes underfunded, low resourced. So why is it important, or should it be important, and how should we approach collecting data as it relates to racial disparities and class disparities? And that's a question for both of you in terms of, we haven't heard a lot about race. We haven't heard a lot about class. I mean, we know, for example, that coronavirus is hitting the elite among us. That is equal opportunity, as Makeda said. But why is it important to think about racial disparities at this moment?
So I'll start off on that. I actually think that it's incredibly important. One of the, I think, artifacts or legacies of this particular crisis is that we are going to have further divides within our society. And obviously in the U.S., we're talking about racial divides, a lot of racial divides, and obviously income divides. I think it's going to be extremely important for us to be collecting data on the disparate impact, essentially, of this virus across a range of communities. And while I recognize that we are largely in reactive and firefighting mode, I think it's going to be very, very important. And the reason for that is that when we think forward about 7 or 8 months and Congress is having to think about another or a couple more very, very large infusions of cash, it's going to be important for us to understand where the devastation has been greatest and to have that data available, because those who have the greatest number of resources are going to be knocking on the doors of various representatives, and they are going to be representing themselves. And for communities that don't have those kind of lobbying resources, it's going to be very, very important for advocates to have that kind of data.
I'll just tack on there and say, this is indeed, just chaotic times. There's very little precedent in history. And it's coming at a time when, for example, we're still, trying to grapple with, what are the boundaries around data privacy and data collection in service of what good? And then the crisis we know is disproportionately impacting low income, low wage, and, very, very vulnerable populations who, are always, find themselves, exploited, especially when it comes to their personal data. But in some cases, their data matters so much today, so that we can understand as people social distance and self-quarantine, what's happening, who's, moving, who's, most at risk. I think it's critical to go back not too far, just a decade ago, when the swine flu pandemic, raced across the globe. Here in the U.S., we know that there was a 2011 NIH study that showed that Hispanic families who tend to live in larger family settings with children were more susceptible to, were at risk for higher exposure to the disease. But African Americans who were exposed to chronic diseases, who had pre-existing chronic disease conditions, whether it was obesity, elevated asthma rates, and heart disease, were the group that faced the highest risk of susceptibility, meaning they succumbed to some of these conditions. So there's real risk of loss of life here. That we aren't able to sort of put our hands on because we're so caught up in the reactive moment of trying to, track where people are and who they're exposed to. I think we have to figure out a way to have an honest conversation about what are the limits of necessary bona fide data collection in the service of the moment. How do we extrapolate the lessons of the past? How do we sort of, pick up the conversations around that have been growing in California and in Europe around GDPR and data protections to guide this moment, but also, let us be agile and flexible enough to, collect the data that we need to be able to respond and manage this crisis. Real lives are at stake.
It is a great point.
So, Rayshawn, I wanted to just jump in and say a couple things about the stimulus package, which you had asked about earlier, and who's not covered. So, as we all know, adults with incomes below $75,000 will receive a one-time payment of $1,200 with an additional $500 for each child age 16 or under. So obviously, people who are over 16, kids who are over 16 are not going to receive checks. But I think what's probably not as obvious is that you have to have a Social Security number in order to receive a check. And so if you are, if your immigration status or your status in general doesn't allow you to have a bona fide Social Security number, you will not receive a check. And what does that mean? That means that if you are in a sort of itinerant status from an immigration perspective, that you absolutely will not have any income from the stimulus package. And you will not have a lot of other protections from the stimulus package. So I just want to point that out because I think it's really important. It actually does impact about 8 million people in the U.S.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I want to build on this and continue to have us think about demographics. And let's talk about place and geography. So, Camille, what do we know about workers who are considered essential? I mean, now all of a sudden that has expanded to include people who previously haven't necessarily been considered essential, but actually, as people are saying, clearly are, whether it be grocery store workers, delivery people, sanitation workers, and the like. And so Judith asked also about the ways that people might be impacted by limits of public transportation, not only trying to get to work, but also trying to get tested. I want to layer this question up and also think about viewers like Carrie Berkeley from DCS, who had questions about people's potential exposure living in certain parts of the country and the impact that this might have on not only urban communities, but also rural communities. We have people from Chicago, such as Allison Brown of CIS, as well as Cheryl Burnett from The Current Company, who asked these critical questions about how we think about urbanicity and what it means to be in rural areas, as well as the impact that public transportation is having, not only on essential workers now, that as that's expanded, but then also the impact on vulnerable populations like the disabled.
That's a great question and a great set of questions. And obviously the group of folks who are now considered essential is growing. And it includes, as you mentioned, people who work at, the CVSs and Walgreens of the world, who are packing groceries for Whole Foods or other Giant or whatever other brands. And of course, our frontline medical personnel, people who are doing sanitation collection, et cetera. What that means is that for those people, we have to absolutely prioritize them when it comes to protective equipment. And I am deeply, deeply disturbed and deeply concerned that we have run out of protective equipment for many of these folks. I mean, and that just is inexcusable in a country like this. So they are at much greater risk, and that is absolutely the case and absolutely demonstrated already. In addition, to talk about urbanicity versus the rural areas, the most important thing that I think we all have to remember about this particular crisis is that it is first and foremost a health crisis. It's a crisis where we are still very much on the back foot with respect to testing for the virus. There are not enough tests for the virus. And the way you get tests is you have tests requested by various official bodies or hospitals. If you are living in a rural area that has a very poor health network, those tests are not going to be requested at the rate that they might be in a New York or a Washington, D.C. And so you might see lower incidence right now of the disease, but that does not reflect the actual incidence of the disease. It reflects the fact that you don't have tests. So being in a rural area is actually quite very negative from the perspective of understanding the prevalence of the disease, because likely the healthcare infrastructure doesn't allow for enough tests to get there. So that's number one. Number two is with respect to urban environments and essential workers. It's true that in a lot of places, public transportation is really skeletal and probably changing, hour by hour. And that makes it very, very difficult for folks to get to jobs. And so I think it's going to be really important for us to figure out if these folks are really essential, how is it that we get them to jobs with, in a way that allows them to deliver on the kinds of services that we think are important. I think a lot of places are trying different things, which are, having skeletal service, having people board the bus from the back entrance, et cetera. But still, the problem is it's very hard for people to get to their jobs. And that makes it very, very difficult to keep a job. And in a place where we have 10 million people who have filed for unemployment in the last 2 weeks and we're counting and going up, we really have to come up with some solutions around that.
So, Makeda, one thing I wanted to ask you about is family. So, I mean, we received a series of questions about family. Anne Marie Bartum from the Barbara Bush Foundation for Family Literacy, Deborah Anderson from the Oklahoma Partnership for School Readiness, and Ellen Reckow, who is the commissioner in Durham County, collectively wanted to know about schooling, technology, family stability, and even the rise of domestic violence. I mean, we know that all of a sudden parents are thrusted into a place, whether they're teleworking or whether they are essential workers, where they are trying to balance that with literally homeschooling their children. And we know that in a lot of places, as our colleague Nicole Turner Lee has written about, that this really impacts people in rural communities and urban communities who don't have access to technology in the ways that some of us actually do who are watching this today. So what impact is the coronavirus having on families? And how does socioeconomic status play a role in how families experience this pandemic differently?
I think, you know, the simple answer, I think it's easy to kind of answer and examine that question through the prism and the lens of education, what's happening in the world of school closures. 124,000 schools closed between last month and, well, in during March. And, you know, as Kimo mentioned, like the scale of this massive school closure is really exposing some deep, you know, gaps. You know, and I think as this dust begins to settle, what we'll see is that a child's zip code is now going to be the most powerful predictor of their academic resilience. There are 55 million students who have been impacted by these 124,000 school closures. 1.5 million of those students are homeless. They're going in and out of, you know, couch surfing. They're in and out of residential or, you know, other kind of group home settings. My husband teaches some of these students, and I've heard over the last 2 weeks, I've been part of these, eavesdropping on these conversations, and my heart breaks when there's a child who shows up to a Google Classroom instance 2 days ago, but dropped off the radar because his dad doesn't have internet access and he has to wait to get back to the residential group home where he doesn't feel safe, but he has internet access and he has school obligations. There are, I think, you know, about 7 million students with special needs and disabilities. Zip code and food insecurity are not going to track one-on-one. There are 30 million children who depend on schools for meals. Yes, the CARE Act has, you know, brought in some relief, but because, like I said, the system's going to be under such strain, some of them will be food insecure for some time until each school district figures out how to balance social distancing, quarantine, keeping their staffers, their staff safe, and delivering these, you know, these really critical meals. All of this is collectively stressing families to no end. And I think, you know, for low-income families, and a lot of this is going to be clustered in low-income communities. So, again, I know that this disease is hitting every single social strata, but we really sort of need to take a moment and, you know, think deeply about where where ground zero will lie. And that's going to be in low-income communities. You know, families are now, you know, stressed with providing two additional meals until those nutritional programs get online. More people in the home means more utility costs, whether it's water, electricity, and gas. It's beautiful here in the district, but in many places, it's still very cold. So I think there are a lot of fronts across which families are being tested. I feel to me it's like a tsunami of destabilization that's just been unleashed. And if we do not get a handle on inequality, it becomes all of our problems. And that's what the stock market has revealed. It is all of our problems. We are connected. We are linked. We have to find a way to cooperate and to decide that inequality is unacceptable, for the richest country in the world. We can solve this. We must make it a priority. We have to prioritize labor, the safety and stability of families over capital, stock buybacks, and CEO parachutes and bonuses.
Yeah, great point. So, Camille, a lot of corporations are furloughing workers. Some of those that are actually going to be increasing revenues and profits after this. Is there a new normal here where, because jobs are scarce, employers have a freer hand around employee protections and benefits. And I want to layer this up with a question we received from Oren, who's a partner at Dahlberg, who said, how do you balance the value of build back quickly, quote unquote, which is more likely to result in a return of more structural inequality, not less, with that, say, a more thoughtful approach to build back with justice and equality? And this is similar to something we talked about earlier, but how do we kind of think about and tease that through as things are moving very fast? I was talking to a colleague who's very high up in one of the largest banking institutions in the country, and he was saying that there isn't a lot of guidance here in terms of what's being done. So it kind of becomes a free-fall, wild, wild west type of approach. So how do you think that that might increase structural inequality? And then how can we do something to make sure that doesn't happen?
Okay, great. So good set of questions here. So I do think that it's very concerning that the businesses that are doing relatively well. So here we're talking about, you know, the Instacarts and Amazons of the world. That many of them have just now, just today, I mean, literally this morning, have just announced that they are now going to be providing health safeguards for their employees who are busy packing groceries and delivering meals, et cetera. So I think it's appalling that we're 4 months or 4 weeks into this crisis, and they are just now, because of agitation from those employees, just now guaranteeing them the kind of protective equipment and as well as protective care for those professions. So it's pretty clear that unless you have some direction from government and from legal entities, that corporations who right now are in a position of being sort of in a position to take advantage of the economy and the way that it's evolved with this crisis, they are doing as much as they can to reap profits without providing the kinds of worker protections that need to be in place. And so we need to have some pretty directive public policy around that. I think that's absolutely clear. To the second part of your question, which had to do with how do we make sure we don't continue to reinstitute the kinds of inequalities and inequities that we see today and we've seen, you know, just prior to this crisis. I think, you know, probably the most important thing I would say about that, and this harks back to another question that was asked earlier, is that we need to start having a kind of equity scorecard against which the corporations that are still in business and still doing well can be held to, a standard there, and also holding that equity scorecard up as a standard for any future provisions and any future legislation, particularly at the federal and state levels.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, an equity scorecard will be very, very appropriate now, really similar to what was done as it relates to a health index and
countries
being prepared to respond to a pandemic, which, I mean, when that report came out, the United States had the number one score only at 84%. But what was interesting there is they had extreme inequality when it came to healthcare and economics, and that's what we're seeing now. So I want to follow this up with a question for both of you that we got from several viewers. James wants to know about the role of economic organizations and the role that they can play now. Karen Stutters and Ann Lynn Oppenheimer want to know about how people with resources can better support marginalized communities. And these communities might include Native Americans, immigrants, and undocumented workers. And I think we also might particularly think about places with large wealth gaps, such as King County in Washington State, where there is no income tax and a small human services budget, yet people like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos reside there. So that's kind of laying it on the line for both of you. Really what people want to know is what can they do in this moment if they have more resources? There are a lot of people asking for money, a lot of people asking for things. How should people think about funneling their resources to help change things moving forward?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, I'll start. I know Makeda has some thoughts about this too. Let me start first with the economic development organizations. So I do not think there is a moment to waste when we think about the power of economic development organizations in collecting and making sense of data as things are evolving, so that that kind of data can be used in future stimulus bills and future policy development that's really literally right around the corner. So I think everybody has a role to play in making sure that the data around the disparate impact of this particular crisis is understood and well known and is marshaled to the types of people who are going to make policy decisions. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of what people can do to help. So the unfortunate thing about this particular crisis is it does limit your physical ability to actually go out and help people. But there are a number of very highly regarded organizations that are doing incredible work on very, very few resources. And many of them exist in our own communities. And I think to the extent that people feel willing and able to contribute dollars to those organizations, I think that would always be really appreciated and really useful. This crisis is not going to end soon. We are probably not even in the middle of it. So I would say that if you know of organizations that are helping vulnerable people, they will need money from now through August, likely. And so if you can donate, I think that's the best way to go.
So I will say that I would argue for maybe three or four system level fixes that, you know, I think we can, that sometimes some of them don't even cost money. First, the SBA loan programs, the payment protection loans, the disaster loans, and the enhanced flexibility under the 7A program are all going to flow through the banking system, not through fintech lenders, but through the banking system. For low-income communities, that means community banks, CDFIs, and minority-serving depository institutions will be inundated with demand, you know, to keep people employed, and you know, in order for these communities to recover on the other side of this, we need to ensure that they're around and they can continue to employ folks and even help keep main streets active without sort of falling into decay. But because this is flowing through the banking system, we saw when the Federal Reserve had an emergency rate cut, Wells Fargo, Capital One, the biggest banks in the system, almost buckled under that weight. They didn't have enough staff. They couldn't, deal with the immediate capacity because it was so overflowing. Could you imagine what that looks like when small businesses are flooding these banks for loans? And the guidance right now is saying you need to call a lender that you already have an existing relationship with and start processing your loan through there. So some institutions can do some of this online, but the bulk of them, the sheer volume of calls means that this system needs some support. In the meantime, whilst they're figuring that out, I just don't think that there are enough funds because the need is so urgent. So great that it'll be enough to cover most of these businesses, and then also cover them for a long time. So I think economic development organizations, CDFIs, need to sort of begin to cooperate and figure out what kinds of patient equity funds, zero interest loans, forgivable loans, you guys can kind of string together to help bridge these companies. They're coming back into a different world. And so they're going to be working to reestablish the market share that they had before and compete for new market share. That's going to take some time. It's not just about keeping the lights on and paying the mortgage. But to that point on keeping the lights on and paying the mortgage, there are, 43.7 million renters in this country? And whilst HUD has, with Fannie Mae, protected homeowners, those 43 million people, 11 million of them are extremely low income renters. They are exposed and they are at risk of losing their homes if this crisis continues, which it will. So we need all of the lobbying support, all of the advocacy to push HUD to a place where it can do the humane thing and freeze evictions as well, upcoming evictions, pending evictions, those that have already been scheduled. We need to have people protected in their homes. We have to at least guarantee some minimum stability for them. Secondly, a lot of the questions that we feel today are around how can we help individual families? We need system level fixes. There are two that I'm thinking of that will cost the taxpayers nothing, but we need Congress to act. One, I think it's important that Congress pass legislation or consider legislation to prevent credit bureaus from reporting any negative information on credit reports, especially for those who've received a stimulus check. I think it's pretty easy to just, you know, administer that kind of check. There are, in addition to the big CRAs, you've got smaller, you know, lesser known credit bureaus like Clarity that, you know, cover the payday loan market, check systems that covers bank accounts. If you bounce a check or you have too many overdrafts, they can make your life miserable and you can, you know, credit report under check systems means you could probably be living in the shadow bank finance system for quite some time. So we need to do that. And I think, you know, the other piece is, I don't think we can rely on the altruism of individual companies, and they've been doing an amazing job of taking leadership, but we can't do it on a case-by-case basis. We need Congress to say, freeze interest rate increases on credit cards and installment loans. I think if we sort of put those measures in place, that gives the, you know, people, individual families, according to their own, you know, circumstances, some time to recover. And so not just through the crisis, but maybe for 6 months after, we need some kind of coverage for people to, you know, bounce back. For a lot of these 10 million UI claims, they're all not going to be approved. Even if they are denied on the first round, they might be approved in late. There's going to be a lot of disruption and chaos in the system. So I really think we need to, you know, step back a little and think about some larger fixes. There are a lot of landlords who are using click notes and, you know, e-writ filings to either automate the eviction process. You're day late, the eviction process is automated, the notices are already out and moving through the courts. For others, in states that don't have strong tenant protection rights, you know, landlords there are, you know, flooding court systems with bulk, you know, filings for delinquent tenants. And I mean, that's meeting up with all, you know, the mess that's already there. So I think we should need to sort of give ourselves some time, but I think there are some ways to push the system that doesn't cost us anything to really provide some coverage and some cover for us to weather this storm, particularly for low-income families.
If I can just add a couple, I know we're almost close to time, but I just want to add a couple of things related to what Makeda just said. So the federal regulators have provided some guidance to credit bureaus about negative credit reports. But to Makeda's point, I think that could be a lot more comprehensive than it is currently. With respect to evictions and other kinds of mandates around service interruptions for utilities, et cetera, many states are doing that on their own. And the National Consumer Law Center has an updated list. They update it daily on consumer protections by state. So I would encourage people to look for that. It's nclc.org. In their library. And then the last thing I wanted to say is that with respect to economic development organizations and for small business loans, I think it is really unfortunate that the SBA was not able to become as flexible in the kind of documentation that they needed from small businesses in order to for these small businesses to get the loans that are part of the stimulus package. What is required is a lot of paperwork. And often you need to work with your accountant to get that paperwork. But if you're in a position where you can't pay your accountant to get that paperwork, it's going to be really hard to apply for SBA loans. I'm particularly concerned for low-income areas where you have communities of color where somebody might own a business, might have a sole proprietorship, and does not have the resources to be able to start that SBA loan process. So I think there's something that needs to be fixed there as well, in addition to the role that CDFIs would play in economic recovery.
I agree. I just want to add there, there is real risk because funds can run out, you know, short space of time for the people who are the firms that are well-organized, most organized and have the capital to get to the front of the line fastest. And that means minority businesses and women-owned businesses are going to probably filter to the back of the line. You know, under the PPP, you can get as much as 10 million. Think of community banks, MDIs, CDFIs, one or two of those kinds of facilities will drain their balance sheets. And so they can only give but so much. So there's real risk of an inequitable, you know, distribution and allocation of those funds. So we really need, you know, economic development organizations to step up to the plate, the self-help organizations to, you know, think and work with these institutions ahead of time to figure out how to make sure we are distributing and allocating access to these funds in an equitable manner. And so that, you know, the most vulnerable firms need to be at the top of the line to get access to the pipeline. I want to just make one last plug. A lot of the front, I kudos, respect, and much love to all the frontline workers, health workers, grocery store workers. One group that we're not talking about are the farm workers who can pose great risk to our supply chain, our food supply chain. In the last couple of days, I think Russia and a couple of the Asian countries have begun to stockpile. That should make us really concerned. This is an area where undocumented workers tend to thrive, you know, trying to find work. It works for the farmers who can't afford to pay higher wages to, you know, keep our food affordable. Seasonal workers as well. So there are a lot of people, to the first question I fielded, who are going to be left out of the safety net. But they are systematically important to all of our livelihoods. And so when I said inequality this time matters for all of us, it certainly does.
One quick thing about you know, folks who are farm workers and other kinds of migrants in other countries, particularly in Europe, we're starting to see that migrants and people of a more tenuous immigration status are being considered residents for the purpose of getting health care and getting some aid. And I would highly recommend that we do that as well. Go ahead, Rishon.
Oh, I mean, this has been great. I mean, the policy recommendations that you all just gave were phenomenal. And I think it's tons of gems here. Unfortunately, we are out of time. And so to Mike Chesser from the Committee for Economic Development, as well as Luis, who was viewing online as well, we'll be doing some work as it relates to incarcerated people, as well as over-policing a marginalized community. So definitely look out for upcoming webinars, as well as written work on that. I really want to thank Camille Bousset and Makeda Henry for joining us this afternoon for a very, very important conversation on vulnerable populations. We thank you for joining us and look forward to other work that's coming from the Brookings Institution. Thank you and have a good evening.
Thanks, Rishon, and thanks, Makeda, and thanks everybody who joined us.
Thanks, everyone. Send us your questions. We'd love to know your thoughts.
Stay safe and healthy.